We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
You're tuned to the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580, FM 90.9 HD2, online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Today we're going to take a look at the rise and fall of a brand. The brand is Starbucks. Our guest is historian Bryant Simon. He says by looking at why America embraced Starbucks, we can gain a better understanding of, in his words, how consumption and culture, the public and the private, interact in our society. Bryant Simon lays out the story in his book, Everything But the Coffee, Learning About America from Starbucks. When Starbucks opened its first store in Seattle, it was about coffee, but that changed. In the 1990s, Starbucks was about style and status. One of the ways Simon puts it is this: buying in post-Reagan America was not about keeping up with the Joneses. It was about separating yourself from the Joneses. Listeners, you can join the discussion with a telephone call. I look forward to your questions and comments. The numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number, 800-222-9455. 800-222-9455. W-I-L-L. Bryant Simon is professor of history and director of American studies at Temple University. Everything But the Coffee, Learning About America from Starbucks, is published by the University of California Press. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Bryant Simon, welcome. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
Sure, my pleasure. Well, when and how did you come to think, hey, you know, Starbucks is selling more than coffee?
Well, I talk about this towards the end of the book, but I ended up at a Starbucks in suburban Atlanta on a New Year's Day, and I didn't have much to do. Everyone at the house where I was staying was sleeping, and I just sat there for an hour and a half and watched the comings and goings, listened to the conversations, and I began to think something was going on here, and I wanted to understand it. And I liked coffee, and I liked hanging out in coffee shops, so it made for a kind of good project for me.
Yeah, and on that New Year's Day, it felt like there was a community thing going there, but when you got into it, that community is not very tight.
Yeah, I started the project really thinking almost more specifically that by studying Starbucks, I would study how people created and reproduced community in America in a kind of suburban age. And I started the research by just hanging out at Starbucks. As I know, I went to maybe 450 Starbucks, and I spent a lot of time there. And I watched what people did, and generally what people do at Starbucks was meet someone they already knew, or they spent time alone in public. But what was even more interesting to me is that it didn't stop Starbucks from marketing the idea of community, which suggested to me, and other conversations suggested to me, that there was a need for community. People went to Starbucks seeking that community, and often that's not what they found.
Hmm. Yeah, this is really, I think, at the heart of your book, is that Starbucks has marketed itself in part as a community, as a civic space, as a place where you belong, and in turn, and here's the interesting thing, you say that's usurped portions of our public life.
Yeah, I think what happens is that, so you sort of pull back a little bit. You know, much of the 1980s, Americans spent sort of retreating inward, and we have the symbols of this in our houses, that the most prominent feature is a guitar, and us driving military vehicles, of cell phones at first were really safety devices, and there was a real retreat from other people, and particularly strangers. And I sort of talk about how we woke up one day kind of on our cul-de-sacs and rubbed the crusties out of our eyes and decided maybe we didn't like it very much. And it's at that moment that Starbucks breaks, and it looks like a public space. And Starbucks, again and again, markets itself as a public place, a place where communities develop. They market itself as a traditional coffee shop where conversations happen. They play jazz to invoke the traditional coffee shop. But at the center of the traditional coffee shop was conversation, was the kinds of conversations that might alienate people, the kinds of conversations that riled people up, the kinds of conversation that produced talk. And through that talk, we became stronger as a community. Our democracy was invigorated by having debates. And Starbucks marketed that, but that's not quite what they delivered. But at the same time, I think Starbucks taught us how to act in a public space. And we came to believe that what you did in a public space was be alone. They literally designed the round tables, making it hard for people to join us. There's very few rectangular tables at Starbucks. They're those round ones that make us, you know, feel safe in public. They provide Wi-Fi that sort of links us to other people, but not to the people around us. And they became, in many ways, places of respite, and they were good at that. They became places to have a meeting, places to do our work. But what didn't happen at Starbucks, in my observations, was the creation of community, where people who didn't actually know each other in other settings came together and forged deeper bonds with other people.
Yeah. It is interesting, not only at Starbucks, but in many places, coffee houses. And I'm talking about people who are trying to do their best and have a public place. But it seems to me that it's an uphill struggle at the moment with everybody with iPods, iPhones, laptops.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, I think, and I say in the book that, and I say I've lost these sort of skills, that I think this long retreat that we had in this country after World War II into the 1990s of retreating away from the city, away from the street, into our backyards, into our cars, in many ways we lost our third place skills. We don't know how to talk to strangers. When we approach strangers as potentially a threat to us rather than something that can sort of invigorate our lives. And then around us, we've created the tools to keep us alone and separated. And, you know, headphones are the classic thing. It's music that only we can hear, right? And we are social networking that is virtual rather than real. And I think that you're right to point out, and one of the things I try and point out over and over again in the book is that it's not just about Starbucks, it's about us, right? And their success is their ability to market what we want, and the failures sometimes of us to get what we want aren't just Starbucks, they're ours. And so I think this is a good example of it. We say we want community. We say we want connections. We rue the fact that we're isolated, but we practice a kind of alone behavior all the time. I mean, we choose to drive instead of walk. We choose to have sunglasses on. I mean, I live in the city, and people are constantly, you know, even if it's gray out, they have sunglasses on, so they don't have to make eye contact. We choose to talk on a cell phone rather than to hear the voices around us and plug ourselves into an iPod. And I talk about how we sometimes go to a Starbucks and we pull out our laptop, we put on our iPod, we have our cell phone there. We've, in a sense, recreated the gated community in public.
Yeah, but yet at the same time, it seems we need a place where we can kind of be in touch with others.
Well, I think, too, here this reflects certain kind of very large changes in American life on two fronts, right? On one level, more and more people are on the go. They need places to go to when they're on the go. More and more people work from home. More and more people consult. Less and less people have the kind of traditional office they go to from 9 to 5. At the same time, libraries have cut back. Hotel lobbies have shrunk. The diners have gone out of business. So the places that we have meetings have sort of fallen away. And Starbucks has sort of filled that void as a place for us to go between work and home. But it hasn't sort of risen to the level, and what it really and it doesn't market itself necessarily as that. It markets itself as a community builder. So it has filled that, I think you're right, that intermediary place, but not the sort of higher level of community some of us say that we want.
How does a brand go about selling community alongside a product?
Well, I think that what we buy increasingly is not products. I mean, that's the sort of world we live in now. The actual physical good hardly matters. It's what it stands for and what it represents, and that's the things that it can associate itself with or how it says something about us. So what Starbucks did, I mean, they talk about selling coffee, but again and again in their own marketing, they talk about this is a place of community. The CEO of Starbucks, the head of Starbucks, Howard Schultz, again and again uses the phrase of calling Starbucks the third place, which he expropriates from the sociologist Ray Oldenburg. And what they're doing is trying to associate, and coffee has long been associated as a community place, as a place that people gather together. They put those images, jazz, sofas, art on the wall, together in a way that invokes community. They talk about it, and those, you know, you take the invocation of community, the talk about community, and together what you get is the marketing of the idea of community. Mm. And literally, if you think about it, at Starbucks, the majority of the customers at Starbucks grab and go. They're takeaway customers. So the people in the store become props, in a sense, for them. Starbucks often puts the comfy couches in the window so you can see them from outside. They want you to stay there so that you lend the place a kind of popularity and community feel for those people in line. Well, that's a way of selling aura, right?
Yeah.
And increasingly, again, nobody needs a $4 coffee. There's no biological need. I mean, you might need the caffeine if you're addicted. And so what they're doing is understanding the way in which buying has exploded in possible meanings and connotations. And they harness that to sell coffee.
Okay, here's a simple and direct question.
Okay.
It might sound a little rude, but, well, what's wrong with that? Why should we care? Who cares?
There's nothing wrong with this. I mean, I don't mean this to be a morality tale against Starbucks. But what it does is it reveals something about us and what we want. So in the first level, we kind of come to understand what we want. And then we come to understand that we don't quite get it. And so if we really want these things, we're going to have to do something different. And I talk about this again and again in the book. If you look at the wants, the desires that Starbucks sells, a desire for community, a desire for a more kind of more just world, desires for a greener planet, those things are all admirable goals, mm-hmm. but we're not getting them through buying. And so it gives us a moment to pause and take stock. Does this really matter to us? And if it does, we might have to go about sort of fulfilling these desires in a different way.
Why do we think...
Was that a direct answer?
Yeah. Why do we think we can get these wonderful things from buying a product?
Well, two reasons, I think. I mean, to again, be as direct as I can. One is because the people with the most power and the most sort of access to information tell us we can. In other words, there are 16,000 Starbucks outlets, and the company generates $10 billion a year in revenue, and they spend a good deal of that revenue telling us what they think we want. The second thing is, and this is a point I make over and over again in the book, other institutions in America have receded. When we used to have neighborhoods where there were front stoops where we gathered on, I mean, we had a firm sense of community. More and more of us belong to associations, PTAs, local political clubs. As that sort of life has receded, brands have taken over more and more of our life, and buying has taken on more and more meaning, and there's less and less to push back on it. And so what happens is companies now sell us what we used to get from other places.
Hmm.
And again, that is one of the reasons to sort of to talk about this and think about it. It's a sort of, you know, state of the union, hopefully, about where we are and if we like where we're at.
Yeah, I think there's been a fair amount of talk recently since this horrible recession, depression, that we are starting to look around and say, you know what, I don't need a $4 coffee, or I don't need Baby Gap, or I don't need this or that. And we're going to have a potluck, and we're going to put in a community garden. And maybe that's, maybe we look at that and say, well, that's neat, but does that have any staying power?
This is to me is a really interesting question. I mean, I was wrapping up the book as, the economic crisis really first began to reveal itself. And so in some ways, I don't get a real chance to sort of take a stab at this question in the book, but it's something I've been looking at a lot. And I think the answer is mixed on this. There is definitely a retreat of luxury spending, of kind of totally frivolous spending. But I don't think that we've stopped buying to express ourselves, or buying, as I talk about in the book, to satisfy a kind of emotional need, or buying to sort of represent ourselves for others to see. I think we've just changed the way that we're doing it. And to me, that's the kind of, you know, less than hopeful part of the story. But there is another part of the story I've been really interested in lately, and that is I think there's this a kind of growing avoidance of brands going on, as particularly at the community level, as and you see it again and again, communities are pushing back against brands. They're saying that by having brands come into our place, it makes every place look the same, and we're losing our sense of place or what's unique about where we live. And so I see a kind of interesting movement and interest again in buying local, which I think is a really positive thing that is coming. It's still buying, but it's at least taking stock in where you're buying and the kinds of things you're buying and what imprint they'll leave on where you live. And so Starbucks has struggled a little bit in the last year. Independent coffee shops haven't. They've done actually quite well. And so we're still buying $4 lattes. We're buying them increasingly at different places.
Yeah, that's interesting. In the course of researching and writing this book, you met a young woman who comes to mind now, Sarah Halterman.
Right.
And she'd been a customer of Starbucks, but then she jumped ship. She told you she was now drawn to mom-and-pop places.
Yeah, and I think that's on the rise. And I mean, I think this in a nutshell, is Starbucks' problem. As I suggest in the book, Starbucks actually started to feel economic pressure before Lehman Brothers imploded, before we all knew. I mean, I think other people knew about the subprime crisis. And that's because the cultural capital had started to drop in the cup. And one of the things I talk about a lot is how I would ask people during my research, well, when you see someone walking down the street with a cup of Starbucks, what do you think? And when I first started the research in 2000, 2001, 2002, people would say, oh, that person's really smart. They have a lot of money. They're sophisticated. They're yuppies. They know something about coffee. And as towards the end, I got this Sarah Halterman answer. Well, they're yuppies in a pejorative sense. They're conformists. They don't know anything about coffee. And so it's interesting. Starbucks started this trend where we began to define ourselves and represent ourselves by the coffee we bought. And the hippest amongst us have rejected Starbucks for something else. And often that's an independent place or a place that sells fair trade coffee or a place that might really reproduce community. And these sort of fragmenting market shares have taken a bite out of Starbucks. And again, I think that happened before the economic crisis hit.
This is The Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon is Bryant Simon. He's a historian. He's the author of Everything But the Coffee, Learning About America from Starbucks. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon. Join the discussion. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, if you'd like to join us. That's 333-WILL. Toll free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. WILL. Well, maybe we could go back to the beginning of Starbucks and examine its history. Who was behind Starbucks at the outset?
Yeah, Starbucks started in Seattle in 1971 by three guys who kind of came out of the 1960s. They weren't quite hippies, but they were affected by the larger cultural politics of the moment. And they had jobs that they weren't really satisfied with, and they wanted to go into a new kind of business where they would sell a sort of authentic or natural product. And they thought about wine, they thought about cheese, and they eventually settled on coffee. And at first, what they sold was coffee, and just coffee, whole bean coffee. They didn't even sell drinks early on. And when they did start to sell drinks, they did it just to introduce people to the coffees themselves. So it was this idea of a kind of revolt against the supermarket, a revolt against standardized products, a revolt against the kind of industrial nature, the lack of naturalness of the products. and that they would sell a more natural product to a niche market. Well, then comes Howard Schultz, who at the time was selling the plastic coffee filters that good drip coffee was made in those days, and he noticed that he was selling more filters to filter holders to Starbucks than he was to Macy's, and he went to visit. He became enamored with the company and talked them into hiring him. And Schultz was never really interested in a niche market. He was interested in the mainstream. And he eventually, through a few twists and turns, which would have the original owners of Starbucks buying Pete's, buys Starbucks and begins to push the company into the mainstream, to make it an everyday product for a mass number of Americans. And his strategy was quite sophisticated. As I read it, it wasn't just about locations, it wasn't about product, it was that he put his stores where high earners, people that others admired, would trip over it. And once they bought it, the emulators followed. And this was a really important model. So he got the rich, the successful, the slightly hip to buy his products. And then people who wanted to be like them started to buy it. And that began the kind of mass marketing of Starbucks. And with that, the products themselves would get sort of transformed, and you went from more authentic drinks, from drip coffee and espresso and cappuccinos to frappuccinos to caramel macchiatos to drinks that were laden with milk and sugar for a mass audience.
Yeah. When exactly did the menu explode with all the choices offered today? And right now I think they've got gingerbread and eggnog and peppermint
season. The McDonaldization of the company, and how does McDonald's continue to get people coming back? Well, its core audience comes for its standard products, but then they change products seasonally, right? And they're constantly offering McRib month and something like that. And Starbucks is borrowing from that, of trying to constantly invigorate its non-core coffee audience with new drinks, and they push those drinks. I was at a Starbucks in North Carolina last week, and someone pulled up to the drive-thru, and I heard the woman say, "Welcome to Starbucks drive-thru. Would you like to try our brand new," I think it was, "creme brulee coffee something?" But part of it was that Starbucks understood that its dark roast coffee would never, I think, reach a mass audience. It was too strong a taste, too particular a taste, and the only way to reach that mass audience was to douse the drinks with milk and sugar and therefore take away the really strong coffee taste. And so that begins around when the company really grows, and just finishing the answer, beginning around 2001, 2002, Starbucks really begins its kind of mass growth. And for about a five-year period, Starbucks would open a new store somewhere around the world every 6 hours, giving it today 16,000-plus stores in 49 countries, serving somewhere in the neighborhood of 45 million people a week.
How long does it take, just to go back to something that's kind of frivolous, but how long does it take a new employee to learn how to make all those drinks?
Well, that's an interesting question, because in the old days, they actually made the drinks.
Yeah.
They would grind the beans and load the portafilter and do the espresso shots, but increasingly now, Starbucks, if you notice the machines, if you kind of peer back behind the milk bar, you'll see that they're just pressing buttons. They don't load. The espresso is a button press.
Right.
So they need to know there's, I think, 87 combinations of drinks. And they need, there clearly is a learning curve to know that. But the actual mastery of the product that used to be part of working at Starbucks is not so true anymore. It is more mastery of the space and learning about what it means to be a Starbucks employee. So when Starbucks employees were trained in the 80s and 90s, they would really be trained in very serious kind of coffee knowledge. And increasingly now what they get trained in is how to work in the stores, how to work the cash register, how to press the button on the machines. And they get a dose of Starbucks culture. They get taught about the history of the company, its social responsibility programs, what it contributes to its communities, those kinds of things, less than coffee knowledge.
Yeah.
Or at least as much as.
What's it like to work for Starbucks?
Obviously you can get, there's 150,000 Starbucks workers, and you can get a lot of answers. I think for the most part, it's not the worst job in the fast food industry, and it's not a great job. I mean, it can be very hard. There's a lot of bumps and injuries, burns, and things like that. On the other hand, it's a pretty clean, safe environment. Customers are reasonably nice, but the things to keep in mind is that nobody who works on the line and serves your drinks works full-time. They work very erratic schedules, and they don't stay all that long. And that's another part of the community feeling in the place. To have a community feeling, you need somebody who's there for a long bit of time, who can kind of orchestrate the customers and introduce them to each other. Starbucks customers like movable parts. They kind of come and go, and it's a hard place to build community. And I think probably the best quote I got is one of my informants said, you know, it's a decent bad job, basically.
Hmm. You mentioned that employees learn from the corporate folks about the so-called, I guess you would say, mission of the operation in terms of what Starbucks is doing, in terms of some of these other things we touched on a little bit earlier, our desire for community, our hopes for the environment, our wish that people are paid fairly and treated justly, the people who are farmers and farm workers. In terms of that message, what's the record?
The record is sort of mixed, and it's the record of, you know, virtually any other company. I mean, what I came to conclude at the end of the day is that while Starbucks claims to be special, it's not particularly special, nor is it particularly bad. And so if you look at the question of, I mean, how it treats its workers, it's not bad. It's not great. It offers health care to workers can buy health care working at Starbucks, but that's a way for Starbucks to get a little higher-end kind of employee and to keep them in there a little longer. It's an economic transaction. It's not a gift, as it's often portrayed. When it comes to buying beans in the global marketplace, Starbucks is the largest consumer of fair trade coffee in the world, but that only represents 6% of its total purchases. The rest of its beans it pays a decent price for and tries to do what it can to get farmers to leave a lighter and more sustainable imprint on the environment, to not hire child workers. But at the end of the day, it needs a steady supply of beans, and that often trumps some of this kind of ethical mission making. On the environment, it says on every cup, help us save the planet. But and while they do use cups that have post-consumer fiber in them, they're still pushing paper cups. And every time you buy a paper cup from Starbucks with a sleeve and a plastic lid on it, that goes back into the landfill, and we all pay for it. So what you get from Starbucks are some pretty strong and important promises. And in the end, what you get is they fulfill those promises more in form than in actual substance.
How do other roasters compare?
You know, it's a mixed bag on some level. Many smaller roasters buy all fair trade beans. And fair trade is a complicated category and a complicated designation. But you do know when you buy fair trade coffee that a particular smaller farmer is going to get a decent wage for that coffee. Not great, but it is the difference between abject poverty and getting by quite often. So if you go into a place that sells all fair trade beans, you know what you're getting, sort of. If you go into a coffee shop that's using compostable cups, which some do, you know those cups are biodegradable, and they will eventually rot in the landfill and not sort of occupy space. You know if you're going into a coffee shop that has real green sensibilities, they're going to push hard, and I mean hard, to get you to, when you drink there, you drink out of ceramic cups, and you use your own cup to leave. They don't care if you walk down the street with some other person's cup. Starbucks, I think, really wants to have, you know, someone like you walking down the street with its cup. It's a good advertisement for them. So the labor question is an interesting one. Often your independent coffee shop that might have really good politics or might have a particular kind of politics you identify with probably can't afford to pay health care. to its workers. I mean, it's just too costly for them to do so. I think, you know, that point, and if that matters to you, that leaves you with certain decisions on this current healthcare debate. Some coffee shops really do care deeply about community and try and stage kind of meaningful debates that they're willing to risk maybe alienating a few customers to elevate the conversation in their towns. They will go out of their way to hire people who need a job and to contribute back to that place. And, you know, the other thing about buying local is more of your dollars go back to the place that you're at. More of your professional service dollars, more of the people, the jobbers they hire go back. And so they might leave a kind of stronger imprint on the local economy.
Do you think that Starbucks will rethink what it does, or is it just it's so big that it has to operate in a certain way in order to continue?
Well, I think that Starbucks is constantly rethinking what it's going to do, and it depends what you mean, like in what exact categories. I think that but Starbucks, in the end of the day, in some ways, is a reflection of us. And I think that if people in this country demanded that all the coffee they drank was fair trade and they would drink nothing else, Starbucks would buy all fair trade coffee. There's enough of it out there. They could do it. If people demanded and that they wanted reusable cups and they wanted discounts on their takeaway cups, I think Starbucks would do it. I think community gets a little bit more difficult, but there are cases where people triumph and create community at Starbucks. I mean, that's about us to a certain extent. Again, I think one the interesting thing about studying a really popular mass-based company, it could be Disney, it could be Target to a certain extent. The way it does business is a reflection of us to a certain extent.
Yeah. It is interesting. I have been in Starbucks in the Chicago area where they had an area for people to get together. And when I was there, there was a group of parents that came in to talk about a project at their school, and they had their kids in tow. And they had a long table and chairs. I thought that was...
Yeah, this is interesting. They are seemingly introducing more and more of these long rectangular tables to the stores. I think that'd be a great thing to do. We need more and more spaces where we can get together and we can have conversations. We need those places to be unfettered and free in the sense that we can say what we want to say. And so I'm an optimist. I mean, I'm glad to hear that that's happening and that people are doing it. And I also think, again, that is – and all of these points, these are reflections not just of how Starbucks does business, about who we are. And we need each other to sort of work through this kind of hard time, and we need spaces where we can get together and talk. And I'm thrilled to hear that people in Chicago are taking advantage of Starbucks' relatively open access and using that space to sort of further the aims of their community. It'd be interesting to see if Starbucks would encourage that or not.
Also, there's a place that I visit from time to time where they know myself and my husband, and when we come in, they know what we're going to order, and they serve it in a ceramic mug, and they warm it up for us before they put the coffee in, which is pretty nice.
Well, and again, first of all, it makes the coffee taste better, and Starbucks will greet you as well. They actually train the people to greet you so that you'll come back. And one of the reasons, one of the things I explore again and again in the book is why we were willing to pay the premium for coffee. And one of the reasons gets back to the notion of community. We would pay for recognition. We feel isolated enough. We like to be recognized. We want a connection. And Starbucks understands that, and so does your community coffee shop. And mm-hmm. It feels good. There's no getting around that.
Yeah. Well, the people in the independents know us, too. I guess we drink a lot of coffee. But anyway, it is, you know, that is something that I think is okay to pay for, is some recognition and some service and being treated like a human being.
I totally agree. And again, what I'm trying to explore in the book is, I could have written a book about independence. I mean, it would have been hard as a research model. And I think, again, this reflects how we value things. And as you noted at the top of the show, I call the book Everything But the Coffee. And in a sense, the last thing we're paying for is the coffee. So a sense of recognition we're willing to pay for. I talk about how we often rent space, and in fact, in places like New York or here in Philadelphia, we might pay to rent a bathroom for a moment because we have so few public bathrooms. And then we pay to carry the cup of a company who we think is doing good work because we want other people to see us associated with those good works, thinking that we value those things. That's what we're paying for. And it's not just Starbucks. It's in all kinds of different products. Designer bags to cars to pens, these objects are laden with meanings. And so I picked one object. I could have picked an iPod, you know what I mean? That's laden with meaning and tried to untangle those meanings to what it said about us and where we would go from here.
Why are we drawn to brands?
Well, on one level, we're drawn to brands because we're drawn to predictability. I mean, we live in a world with so much choice that we can almost be numbed by it. But we also live in a world where we're constantly on the go and we want to know we're going to get something that we expect. And we're drawn to brands because brands inundate us with the message that brands are a good thing. So, you know, it's this combination of things about changes who we are and the power of marketing. But again, you hinted at it earlier, I detect a kind of growing brand avoidance where the values of predictability, the values of sameness are being trumped by the costs of predictability and sameness.
Yeah. I remember a few years ago now, one of my brothers and I were in the Dallas-Fort Worth metro area, and we had to do a lot of driving, and it was almost a daily commute to get to where we were staying to where we were going. And it was, at first, it was so confusing because going down the highway, it was the same chains over and over and over again as you went from suburb to suburb to suburb. And if you weren't paying attention, you could miss where you were supposed to get off because it was like, where are we?
Right.
And then the big fun thing at the end of the day was, okay, it's your turn to pick somewhere to get a bite to eat, but no chains. We got to find something that says Dallas-Fort Worth. And that was fun. It was fun. But it was amazing. It was like, where are we?
Well, and I think that's particularly true the newer the city you get. Like, so the cities with the highest concentration of Starbucks per capita are almost all Sunbelt cities.
Hmm.
Yeah, but again, I think this is what people are pushing back against increasingly. The way in which people have called clone towns or this monoculture landscape have made every place look the same. And part of the resistance to brands, I think you can see it in the proliferation of farmers markets, the proliferation and kind of here in Philadelphia. I don't know if you have these of gastropubs. I saw this in Japan recently in nomia culture, people rediscovering kind of little small places, is the attempt to invigorate and make place matter again.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Historian Bryant Simon is our guest. He's the author most recently of Everything But the Coffee, Learning About America from Starbucks. Let's take a call now from a listener waiting for us in Urbana on line one. Hello.
Hi. I was going to ask about the poor quality of America's coffee in earlier years. And one of the things that was very appealing about Starbucks was that it was actually quite good, and they did things like throw out coffee that was old and things which just were not all that common in the U.S. In the early years of Starbucks. Is that something that struck you as worthy of people giving them business? And that may be a reason why people turn up there, even if they aren't participating in community.
Absolutely. I mean, I write about in the beginning of the book that Starbucks upgraded the category of coffee, and I don't think there's any doubt about that. And as your listener points out, American coffee was pretty crappy. And basically, you can see the rollover effects of this that everywhere now claims to have good coffee. And so part of the initial appeal was better coffee. And then what Starbucks did was sort of leverage that. It sort of suggested that because it knew about coffee, it knew about you could trust it for other things. And so the coffee and the decent taste of it was always part of the fundamental proposition. From there, again, it sort of leveraged into other areas that allowed it to continue to charge the premium.
Yes, thank you for the remarks.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Yeah, you know, when you think about it, you think about the coffee that Bryant, you and I grew up watching our parents drink. It was pretty grim stuff.
I quote the Tom Waits song where at Nighthawk's Diner, where he talks about he's at a diner and his veal cutlet gets off and starts a fight with his coffee, but the coffee's too weak to defend itself.
Yeah.
And that coffee sitting on the burner forever. You remember that? But it is interesting, though taste is only part of it. I mean, taste in our culture is not objective. And the fact that you appreciate better taste and that you can discern better taste and discern kind of the distinctions between better taste, as you pointed out in the introduction, is not just about taste. It's about making distinctions. It's about saying, I'm better than you in some ways. And increasingly better in America, as David Brooks pointed out in Bobo's in Paradise, is about having more knowledge. So appreciating Starbucks reflected a kind of knowledge. And I can remember, I was recently called this story. When Starbucks first got started in the kind of mid-90s, I just finished graduate school and I had my first job. And I remember sending my advisors back Starbucks coffee. And it was a way for me to say I was a grown-up and I had a job and I could afford to do it. But I was trying to also communicate something with myself that I was going to get them a treat, something better that they couldn't get where they were at. And I probably wouldn't do that now. I mean, that wouldn't be the same. It wouldn't have the same effect on them. And I think that speaks to part of the dilemma that the brand's in now.
Mm. And thoughts on other chains offering what we might call fancy coffees today? McDonald's, Dunkin' Donuts, everybody's in the game.
Yeah, now that gets back to your caller's question. I think that Starbucks raised the bar on coffee for everyone, and also along with it, and I think this is important to recognize, the ability to charge more for coffee for everyone. They go together, right?
Yeah.
And but I don't think that initially is what hurt Starbucks. I think that what happened was Dunkin' Donuts and McDonald's were marketing better coffee to their audience, which wasn't necessarily Starbucks' audience. Starbucks devotees would not have switched to McDonald's or Dunkin' Donuts. But as Starbucks' cultural cachet fell, as the Sarah Haldermans and others no longer saw the people carrying Starbucks as looking so good, that brought Starbucks into competition with McDonald's and Dunkin' Donuts, because now it is kind of just about the coffee. And so you go to the most convenient place to get something warm, to get your fix. And here, I think, again, taste doesn't much matter probably to people. It's just, you know, caffeine and having a cup of coffee.
Let's take another call. Listener in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Well, I think the cachet for Starbucks has been the idea, and I emphasize idea, that you're buying a premium coffee. And quite frankly, you know, I have stopped at Starbucks across this country. I traveled quite a bit. And quite frankly, I find Dunkin' Donut coffee a better flavor and taste than I do Starbucks. So I guess what I'm saying is, bottom line, it's cachet is the idea that you're buying a premium coffee. It doesn't necessarily mean that you're getting that product when you're buying.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't agree more. I mean, since this is central to what I write about in the book, is that it's the idea and the idea that you're getting a premium coffee, but then what does that say about you? It says that you understand how to make that distinction about what's premium, and that you also have the money to pay extra for coffee. In many ways, Starbucks was, as I say in the book, a kind of affordable form of conspicuous consumption. It was a way, you might own a BMW, but you can't carry it everywhere with you. But you can show everyone you can overpay for coffee. Dunkin' Donuts is marketed in a different way as a kind of practical product for everyday people. The taste question is interesting as well. I mean, they are different roasts. Starbucks has long used very dark roast. Some people think that the beans are burnt. Dunkin' Donuts has sold a much more medium, kind of smoother taste. And so there is a taste difference there. And Starbucks recently introduced a new blend that it invoked its own past. And it was a blend that tasted a lot like Dunkin' Donuts, trying to capture customers like your caller.
Mm-hmm. There, we've got to leave it. We're out of time. Bryant Simon, thank you very much for joining us this
afternoon. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Bryant Simon is a professor of history and director of American Studies at Temple University. His book, Everything But the Coffee, Learning About America from Starbucks, is published by the University of California Press.